You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source is WRIR's weekly audio news digest. Today on Open Source, the Richmond Triangle Players began their run in the attic of Fieldin's, a gay-friendly after-hours club. But boy, have they bloomed in the 20 years since their humble founding. We talk with Managing Director Philip Crosby. Also, as controversy raged over whether reviled Boston bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev would find a final resting place, Martha Mullen did the only decent thing. She got him buried. She joins us along with the Reverend Elaine Cameron Miles, an expert in bereavement, and the officiant at the funerals of the Harvey family. But first, here are some of the week's top headlines.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Brittany Tracy, and here's the news. Richmond Public Schools voted Monday night to reclose A.V. Norrell Elementary School, the controversial school built on a dump and closed amid swirling controversy and sewage after 2006 Tropical Storm Ernesto flooded Battery Park. The closure was one of three announced as a cost-saving measure for the district in its effort to balance its budget. Norrell reopened last year, dredging up even more controversy than when it first closed, as the district moved pre-kindergarten and early childhood programs there as a temporary measure during construction at Martin Luther King Middle. Activist group Parents for Life protested the school, and a number of new school board members pledged that they would close the school if elected last November. But since their election, public support for school closures fell off. An announcement earlier this year that the board planned to close two schools was met with public resistance, and last month the board voted to reverse its closure plan. Monday's vote, which also closed Clark Spring Elementary and ACDC, one of the district's alternative schools, came as a surprise, as reported by Open Source RVA's Cameron Vigliano. On Thursday, Mayor Dwight C. Jones attended the dedication of the new 2nd Street Connector Road, which slices downhill along the west property line of Tredegar Ironworks. The road was completed at the expense of a small portion of the historic Kanawha Canal wall. In October 2012, various civic groups urged the Richmond Police Department and the Department of Public Works to conduct a civil and potentially criminal investigation after that demolition also resulted in the accidental destruction of an additional 150 feet of the historic wall. The Oregon Hill Neighborhood Association, the Historic Richmond Foundation, and the Inland Waterways International Organization, among others, say information on the circumstances by which 150 feet of the original canal wall, dating to the 18th century, was destroyed have been delayed, and the status of any such investigation remains unknown. At the time of the demolition, city officials indicated they were uncertain of who approved or initiated the demolition. Ty Potterfield in the city's planning division said in reports last year that an investigation is underway, and the city's official response indicated the investigation, quote, could take weeks. City spokesman Mike Wallace confirmed to Open Source that the investigation remains ongoing. Police did not respond to two similar requests for information from Better Government Richmond. In an ironic juxtaposition, Virginia Senator Timothy Kaine released his new sponsored Senate proposal last Friday. The American Battlefield Protection Program Amendments Act would allow Civil War-related historic sites to achieve federal grant funding. The canal was instrumental in wartime production in Richmond, as it runs adjacent to Tredegar Ironworks, the South's primary producer of armaments, including the first Southern ironclad ship, the CSS Virginia. The Richmond Department of Social Services is still reeling after the damaging audit conducted at the behest of City Council was released last week, and the beleaguered department, which handles child welfare cases, among other duties, remained on the defensive after a report early this week by Channel 6 that Social Services Director Doris Mosley might remain on the job for some time in spite of Mayor Dwight Jones's indication that he'd accepted her immediate resignation. The audit exposited instances of bureaucratic mismanagement, including coercion and intimidation of employees, a scattered filing system in which hundreds of confidential case files may be incomplete or missing, and evidence that children were consigned to dangerous or neglectful home situations instead of being placed in the foster care system. Mosley and former Deputy Chief Administrative Officer Carolyn Graham had defended the department, saying it was following the Virginia Children's Services practice model, which urges the decrease of the foster care population. The audit found that Richmond was strongly discouraging and even refusing emergency removal orders and personal protective orders for children in dangerous placements. In response to what the department called failures of leadership, Mayor Jones accepted the departure of both Mosley and DSS Deputy Director Gail Turner. Following revelations that Mosley remains on the job, Council President Charles Samuels and 3rd District Councilman Chris Hilbert, both of whom were involved in exposing the troubled department, expressed dismay. Further investigations from the state social services officials and the Child Welfare League of America are still outstanding.
In spite of the seeming simplicity and unavoidability of the act, death and dying is never easy. It's painful for survivors, and in cases where death takes the form of tragedy or trauma, it can draw out an amazing array of emotions. Some of those emotions are easy enough to understand. Others are far more complex. Martha Mullen, champion arm wrestler and licensed counselor in private practice, is with me today, and also the Reverend Elaine Cameron Miles, a Unitarian minister who specializes in death, dying, and bereavement. Miles may be familiar to some of you as the officiant at the funeral services for the Harvey family. Ricky Gray, one of their killers, sought this past week to avoid his death sentence, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But first, Martha made headlines last Friday when it was announced that she personally paid for Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother of the duo who carried out the Boston bombings last month, to be buried here in Caroline County. But afterwards, Tsarnaev's body was in limbo for weeks after the bombing because of public outrage over plans to provide burial near his adopted home and the site of his crime, Boston. Martha, thank you for being with me.
Sure.
And Elaine, thanks for being here as well.
Sure.
All right, so I guess let's start with Martha. Martha, you've been as much a subject of this range of human emotion displayed about this tragedy as any of the victims, or for that matter, the bombers. How's that been for you, I guess, being in the middle of that?
Actually, I did offer to put forward a sum of money to kind of encourage other people from an interfaith perspective, perhaps, to donate, people or organizations. And actually, the cemetery where he is buried, the people who administrate that elected to offer the plot free of charge to the family, and they have resources to do that. And I could, so then I contributed to replenishing the resources. But I think it was, in my mind, very generous of them to offer the burial side to the family, to the uncle, who I think got saddled with this and of course, stepped up to the plate, which is, commendable.
Well, and that's a very interesting distinction. So yeah. What you really did was you sort of paid it forward in a way.
Pretty much, yeah. I paid it forward after the fact, actually, because when they responded to my email, interestingly enough, Tuesday morning a week ago, I think it was the 7th, I just emailed a bunch of different faith organizations, and even my own pastor thought it was spam and almost deleted it. So, I think it's interesting that, the people who did respond, I'm sure other people probably would have responded, but they just probably saw the tag, which I didn't think. I put, burying Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And so the Islamic Funeral Services of Virginia responded, and they said, well,
how many responses did you get, and how many did you send?
The email went to, I'm a member of the Jewish Community Center, so I sent an email out to I wasn't sure who I should email, so I just sent it to the CEO, and I sent it to the Hindu temple. There's a website, I think they're on Springfield, and I sent it to my pastors, and then I sent it to the Islamic Federation of Greater Richmond, and then they forwarded it to the Islamic Funeral Services of Virginia, and they're the ones ultimately who responded, and they offered the plot. And then after that, then it was between the funeral home director up there, Peter Steffen, and the Islamic Funeral Services of Virginia, and then the uncle of Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Something got through to you. I don't know if it was through that article, but...
I just kind of had this... Well, there's a favorite quote that I have from Gandhi. It says, whatever you do may seem insignificant, but it's most important that you do it. And then I was thinking, you know, Jesus says, love our enemies, and I'm a Christian, I'm a United Methodist, and I was also kind of just really, I guess, irritated with my fellow countrymen. This is more than just the burial of a violent person creating this flap. And the only difference that I could see, and I'm certainly willing to be wrong, but the only difference that I could see was the fact that he was Muslim.
How did you get to that? Because, again, you were talking a little bit about that before the mm-hmm. broadcast, and you had a process that you arrived at that through that I was... It's not just as simple as that, in other words, the way that you described it earlier when you were talking with Elaine.
Well, I think that when we were talking, we were trying to differentiate, what exactly is the difference here? And I think part of it was that no one was willing to claim the body at first.
Right. Normally we have a family who is stepping up in some way and then privately and discreetly taking care of the burial mm-hmm. or cremation concerns. Mm-hmm. And we have multiple examples of that. Then we have examples of famous criminals who were cremated, but that wasn't an option here.
Right.
We can also talk about America.
And it was not an option because of his religion.
Not an option because of his religion, and also because, the Geneva Conventions talk about burial that is respectful of the person's religion. And so that's, what we're trying to do, and cremation is generally not done in Islam. What Martha and I were talking about is that I see it as kind of a trifecta of strikes against him, which, one, it was a terrorist act. Mm-hmm. Two, it was very recent, mm-hmm. and so dealing with the issue of a body the family isn't claiming on a recent event is, we don't have a lot of precedent for that. And then the fact that he is Muslim and the burial requirements and that cremation is not an option is all part of that problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's problematic to begin with respect to finding a place to inter him. And I understand that they had lots of different options and offers, well over 100, 150. But the localities the funeral officials or the cemetery administrators from wherever those places were like, no, we don't want to take this on. So there was kind of a reluctance
to even take the body.
And then I think it seemed to me there was some xenophobia going on and some discrimination because he was Muslim. And I'm a very big believer in interfaith issues and the fact that every religion has a right to peacefully coexist with every other religion, and there are many things we can learn from many different religious traditions. And I feel, in this country, ever since 9/11, that the Islamic community has been considerably vilified. To a greater or lesser degree, depending on, I'll just give you an example. They asked me to be the spokesperson because they were concerned about backlash, and we prepared a press release because they were concerned about backlash, and then there was a considerable amount of backlash.
So that was one of the immediate criticisms of you in the mm-hmm. wake of this was, she put out a press release, mm-hmm. but that was something you were asked to do?
I was asked to do that. The people at the Islamic Funeral Services of Virginia said, well, look, we think we need to draft a press release so that we can explain why we did this and what our concerns were. And it was very simple. And they asked me if if I would be willing to release that and be the spokesperson for them, because they were concerned about backlash. I mean, and these are people who have been in this country for years, who are professionals. I agreed not to identify any of them. But they were very concerned, rightfully so. So I think. The fact, and I have since heard that from some of them have told me that some of their friends have said, you know, we're really glad that she took this on. We were concerned, but she stood up for us. You know, she stood up for the Muslim community.
Now, what I find interesting between the two of you is both of you have dealt with. You said you'd worked with hospice.
Mm-hmm. No, she had worked with hospice, and okay. I've worked with people who have grief and loss and dying issues.
Of course, in your profession. Mm-hmm. And I guess so you both have sort of this commonality, this sympathy, this empathy for regardless of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody dies, and it's a crossing over. It's a process.
And grief is a very unique experience, depending on people's culture, the circumstances of the death, what people are prepared for. And so what concerned me immediately when the news broke that it was an issue about where the body would be buried is that brings up things for all kinds of people who have no ties to Boston whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of burial and final resting place can be very troubling, mm-hmm. for grieving people. I certainly agreed with the police chief of Worcester that we are not barbarians. Mm-hmm. We bury our dead.
Yep.
And so that needs to happen. I think the reason, and what hasn't been stated, I know enough cemetery owners and funeral directors to know that they put out a lot of pro bono stuff, and they don't talk about it. They're very quiet about it when it's a child or, you know, an elderly person who lived a long life. But it also has to be done for people who are accused of crimes. Mm-hmm. And they don't talk about that part of what they do. And so money was part of this.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't hear that brought up as much about that side of cemetery life and funeral director life. But I'm not at all surprised that the funeral director was one of the most compassionate figures in this narrative.
Very much so. Yeah.
Because of what they see every day and what they have to do every day. It's certainly a very American job.
Mm-hmm.
You do it for everyone equally. Giving everyone the best treatment you can.
That's very true. He was one of the first people who dealt with AIDS victims who had died, and he took Peter Steffen.
I remember reading that. Yeah,
yeah,
that
somebody.
he was very compassionate toward it. And again, this is another group that and now clearly these are victims. Mm-hmm. We understand that now.
Sure.
But at the time,
you know, people were
30 years ago.
Vilification
of
those people who clearly did something.
There was a blaming and a kind of a, well, they deserve that. And there was that same sort of thing with, you know, there was a vindictiveness and a vitriol about, you know, some of the things on the web. You know, he should be fed to the worms. He should be, you know, those kinds of things. And I guess that's a concerning thing for me because there was a article, I can't remember who wrote it, but he was saying, you know, one of the part of the responsibilities of living in a civilized society is that we extend the right of burial to everyone. You know, that's what we do. We don't put heads on pikes outside of cities. We've gotten past that in our history. And so, you know, that's I think it's just telling that this touched a huge nerve in people.
Now, Elaine, you did a little bit of research before
mm-hmm.
coming here, of course, and yourself, you've officiated for the victims of somebody who in the future may be somebody we don't really want to have buried next door. and of course, I guess leading out of all of this, we've seen quite a bit in the news about some of these, Jeffrey Dahmer, et cetera, and where they're buried. But they're really, in I guess, the history of people that we don't want to bury, there has been, a tradition of compassion, it seems like.
Right. When you look at a transition out of, let's start with the Hebrew scriptures, the first thing I thought when I saw that they were having trouble finding a place to bury him was, we don't treat people like Jezebel. Mm-hmm. And Jezebel, her story comes up in 1 and 2 Kings in the Hebrew scriptures, and it's a story of a mixed marriage, a mixed cultural marriage of royalty. And she came from a culture who worshipped Baal, and her husband Ahab, who was a king of Israel, he, of course, came from a culture that worshipped Yahweh. And because of her behavior about her religion, she was thrown from a window, defenestrated, and dogs chewed her up and scattered her about, which was a punishment that the prophet Elijah had foreseen as the worst possible thing, so that the people who loved her could not go anywhere to say goodbye to her. Mm-hmm. And I know that some of the residents in the area of the cemetery, who actually had no idea the cemetery was there until recent events.
It's on private property.
And I know of other places, other cemeteries in Richmond, who do Muslim burials as part of a part of what they do. Mm-hmm. And they're concerned about who would come to the graveside. So we look at these things, but I think the most connected one, when I went back through history and looked at serial killers and terrorists and assassins, I think that the 9/11 terrorists are probably the saddest story for the victims. And I think if you consider the fact that the victims' families will always know that the remains of those who killed their loved ones are forever linked, quite literally, mixed in with their loved ones because of the way they died, that is a serious grief trauma. Finding a place to put Tamerlan Tsarnaev, we can do that, mm-hmm. We can do that, we can make that happen. Separating out just the DNA of the attackers from the victims of 9/11 can't be done.
Martha, has your family heard? What's been the repercussions for you and your family?
It's been, I think, as far as my my immediate family and their reaction. I have a brother-in-law who's from Massachusetts, and he was like, not so much,
not happy with you.
A fan. He was like, well, I wouldn't have done it, but I thought he should have been buried at sea. But I have some other friends, other relatives from Massachusetts on my husband's side, and they're very, very supportive, and they said that they actually knew some people who were injured. And those people said, we're just glad it's done so we can focus on the healing. And I think that was my intent, was let's stop talking about that. So I know the political will isn't there, or it's a hot potato. Let's just deal with it so that we can get back to healing and the focus on the victims and the recovery. And that was a big part of the forging ahead. And, the issue is, I was even reluctant to do the interview today, but
I know, we talked for a little bit. And in fact, I should probably explain the arm wrestler thing real quick, since I did mention that in the introduction. Martha came to Hamaganza, which is a yearly benefit concert that I helped to organize, or I do organize.
Yeah.
And she arm wrestled school board chairman Jeffrey Bourne, not yet seated at the time, but in fact, she unseated him, beat him in record time, I think.
without benefit of alcohol either.
So. And she was just there. But we thank you for your ham and for your donation to the food bank. So.
Yes, a ham from a ham. So there you go.
But again, I'm sorry. Back to.
But I think the important thing is that as conflicted as people felt about this, the important thing is to focus on healing as a nation and getting back to what's really important, certainly as the national issues.
Do you feel like you kind of took one for the team? And which team did you take it for?
You know, it's funny. I don't think it's so much about me. I think, a little bit, yeah. And I think if I had to say the team, I would say, I would say maybe the Muslim tradition, the right to a Sharia burial, if that's something that you feel is necessary. Part of the Muslim community, although the imam from the Islamic Center of Virginia was, I understand, not in support of this for a lot of different reasons, in particulars of faith tradition, and I understand that. I think maybe if I had to say anything, for the team of decent human beings on the planet and in America who still... Who maybe aren't polarized by the war or by religious issues or people who just good, common, decent human behavior. And maybe I took one on the chin for that. I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it till you asked. But
a year from now or 5 years from now, uh-huh. if we had not done right with this person's body,
right.
how would we... feel about ourselves? How would the world view us?
Yeah.
Extrapolate out. These are questions that we do as Americans ask ourselves.
I think what I'm afraid of as an American is that we are, as a nation, becoming less tolerant, less accepting of differences, more rigid and more xenophobic. I don't think that's true of everyone, but it's definitely something that I feel or have sensed. It concerns me because, you know, we as a nation have been involved for well over a decade in the war in Afghanistan and also the war in Iraq. And over 100,000 civilians have died in Iraq alone. And yet, where is the remonstration and the accountability for that? I'm not talking about military deaths. I'm talking about civilian deaths.
Well, I think in the same time frame of these bombings, there was we accidentally bombed a wedding in Afghanistan. That's sort of dropped from the headlines now.
Right, the drone attacks. I guess that's the concern, is like, where ethically and morally, where do we stand as a nation about those deaths and those things? And I'm not exculpating, you know, Mr. Tsarnaev, who I think was made a very heinous decision, heinous act, and a bad choice. And there's all kinds of reasons I could extrapolate about why I think he got to that point, which is not the issue. But I think that, you know, what for me is telling is the fact that there was such a reaction to this. People felt a need to point the finger and to vent. And whenever that occurs, there's always something underlying that. And what is that? And that's the concern that I have.
Yeah, and I think we also saw that with his uncle mm-hmm. and his families. Mm-hmm. You know, as a person who works with death and dying and grieving, I was very interested in how quickly his uncle denounced him and his brother and the ways in which he denounced them.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, I think this burial and discussion about it should really go back to what was being done for the family. You know, are we going to blame an entire family for the acts of two individuals? Are we going to blame Chechnya for the acts of two individuals? Are we going to blame a religion for their acts? Or are we instead going to step up and help their family in a difficult time and move on and,
exactly.
and work toward the victims?
Now, Elaine, that's something that often happens, isn't it? Is the perpetrator's family often finds itself in hiding. These brothers of this fellow who kidnapped the three women who were right. recently freed, and where was right. that in Ohio, are in hiding because right. they're almost guilt by association, mm-hmm. guilt by genetics.
Sure.
And I don't know if this is you probably didn't see any of the Gray family and any of what you dealt with, but I can imagine that they probably are feeling a little bit of heat right now with, mm-hmm. with their son.
Yeah, they have a different location, not being from Richmond, so that's helpful. But I think the more obvious connection is if we go back to the murders that I know the most about of the Harvey family. Mm-hmm. Let us also point out that the same week, the Baskerville family was murdered. Mm-hmm. And the different dynamic because of their daughter Ashley having been involved with the perpetrators. Here we have parents who were innocent and were also murdered, but their death is not honored in the same way as mm-hmm. as the Harveys because of their association with the daughter who was associated with the murderers. So
it was as much a victim in the whole thing as anybody, just mm-hmm. again associated with them was was a girlfriend or
so. That family is not remembered or honored in the same way, in part because of I think the shame of the family of her connections and no one really knowing the depth of those connections. But I think that's a very dangerous slope to start sliding down where mm-hmm. In this day and age, we're not all living on the family homestead over dinner talking about our plans and, you know, our diabolical wishes. These people are not that connected to each mm-hmm. other. And so to blame people in such a mobile society just for having the link of family, mm-hmm. I think it's really dangerous
mm-hmm. I agree.
And upsetting.
Now, with the Harvey family and Mr. Gray appealing his sentence, has that brought up anything for you?
You know, each time it comes up, although, you know, you understand the justice process and that as an innocent person, you would want as many appeals as possible for the truth to come out. It's very upsetting to watch as this person again and again is given those chances. No matter what your belief system about justice is, it's painful to go back there. It's very upsetting, and it brings up a lot of grief, old and you know, causes new grief.
All right. Well, guys, thanks for being here today. Any
sure.
final words from either of you on some of this controversy, either controversy?
I just agree with you that we need to move forward and focus on healing and
Yeah, and I would hope that communities that are affected, instead of having an insatiable desire for information about the accused, would instead have an insatiable desire for information about those who are survivors and who are moving forward with incredible human spirit and with the generosity of people who love them. That's what I would like us to be focused on.
What she said.
What she said. All right. Well, and I've been with Martha Mullen, who, again, she's a licensed counselor in private practice, but she also helped to bring about the final burial of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, one of the Boston bombers, and Elaine Cameron Miles, the Reverend Elaine Cameron Miles. She's a Unitarian minister who specializes in death and dying and bereavement, and she also officiated the Harvey funerals. And has been involved in quite a few high-profile funerals over the years. Thank you guys for being here.
Good job, Martha.
Thank you. You too, Elaine.
Special creation. So, come take a look. Give me the hook or the ovation. I want to have a little pride in my world, and it's not a place I have to hide in. Life's not worth a...
In a town with a thriving and sometimes congested theater scene, Richmond Triangle Players stands as not only a vital source for local theater, but as a sign of Richmond's progress in accepting, even celebrating, its gay community. For more than a decade and a half, the theater company, designed to highlight plays and musicals with gay-related themes and characters, had its home on a small stage located on the top floor of the Fieldings nightclub. But in February 2010, the organization moved into a handsome new home near Broad and Boulevard, a former radiator shop, and has found a loyal clientele that one could hardly call niche. For the past 2 years, RTP has been voted one of the city's best theater companies by Style Weekly readers, and it's living up to its stated goal of being the busiest stage in town by offering a home to outside theater troupes, such as Cadence Theater Company, and staging cabarets, one-act plays, and readings on a regular, sometimes nightly basis. The Richmond Triangle Players concludes its 20th anniversary season with Jerry Herman and Harvey Fierstein's La Cage aux Folles, opening tonight and running through June at the RTP Playhouse. Managing Director Philip Crosby's here with us today on Open Source RVA to talk about the evolution and rebirth of one of Richmond's most vital creative endeavors, and where Richmond Triangle Players may be heading for its next 20 years. Thanks for coming, Philip.
Well, thank you, Don. That was great. Wow. I hope I can live up to the introduction.
Well, you deserve it. I guess you're a busy guy right now. La Cage aux Folles at the Richmond Triangle Players. That sounds like a match
tonight. Made
in heaven.
It is, it is honest to God, the biggest show we have ever done. It has so many moving pieces in it. 15 actors and... probably 100 costumes. I think there are 256 light cues.
Wow.
It's pretty big, but it's wonderful. We had our first preview last night, totally sold out, and the audience went crazy. They adored it.
Well, has the company ever tackled this legendary comedy before?
No, and in fact, no one in Richmond ever has. We were astounded to find out that even though this musical premiered almost 30 years ago, mm-hmm. the only time it's ever been done in Richmond was when it came through on a national tour. Back in the mid-80s.
Well, is it because it's just too big?
I think that's part of the history of it. La Cage opened on Broadway in the mid-80s. Also, what had happened, and some of this is historical, there had been a big push from 69 through the 70s. Of course, it was a much more, in a sense, progressive and liberal time then mm-hmm. than it sort of became in the 80s. But the biggest turn in that for the gay community was the onset of AIDS.
Right.
And as that happened, a lot of attitudes toward the gay community kind of shifted back to the negative, mm-hmm. you know, because they were getting the blame for the disease and the mm-hmm. epidemic at that time. And so this musical, which was celebrating a very normal family, it's just happens to be that the parents are two men,
right,
started to be looked at as something, we don't know if we're comfortable with that anymore. So, that was one reason the musical faded, I think, a bit. But secondarily, it was thought of as being a huge spectacle, which in the 80s it was.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, 2 years ago, a wonderful company just outside of London called the Menier Chocolate Factory, which has a theater not much bigger than RTP's, did a production of La Cage aux Folles with Jerry Herman and Harvey Fierstein's participation. And it's the version that later moved to the West End of London and then moved to Broadway with Douglas Hodge and Kelsey Grammer. And the minute we looked at how they'd rethought it, we went, wow,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
we could do this. Yes,
right.
We can. If you strip away, you know, half the showgirls and some of the spectacle and all this scenery flying about, mm-hmm. it's really this intimate story. So that's what we decided to focus on.
Who's directing?
A wonderful actor and director, local, named Joe Pabst. Joe has done a lot of things at Virginia Rep, and he did his first show with RTP this past fall. He was the lead in our production of Regrets Only, which opened the 20th anniversary season.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And who is starring specifically? Who's going to play the scene-stealing role of Albin?
That is Kirk Morton. Kirk, who has probably performed at RTP more than any other actor and has been sort of our go-to guy for over the last decade. In fact, I don't think in the last 10 years Kirk has performed except in readings and things. I don't think he's actually performed a full show at anywhere else but RTP. Hmm. And when we knew we were doing the show, we said, well, Kirk will be perfect. And I guess we'd better ask him before we have auditions because he might come kill us if he doesn't get a chance to play this role.
Yeah.
Hey, and he's perfect for it.
This is mine.
He's absolutely perfect for it. He'll break your heart.
You kind of touched upon this a minute ago, but speak a little bit about the importance of La Cage aux Folles in kind of breaking down barriers, because I always thought it was a play that kind of skillfully walked the line between playing off of gay stereotypes and also humanizing gays. Central to the play is the committed marital relationship of the lead characters, Albin and George.
Absolutely, and I think it's one of the reasons the original French film was so popular.
Remember
the original French film, which came out in
78
La Cage aux Folles, which is the source material not only for this musical but for the later American film The Birdcage. And before that had been a very popular French play. I think the reason for the success of that back in the 70s is it did, in a sense, normalize this couple.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These were not, at the time, even though one of them is a big flamboyant, you know, drag queen, the fact that they were a couple who raised a son and had the same issues with their child that every parent has. The child is ungrateful. Mm-hmm. The parent feels for everything that the child has been given. The child feels like, well, you never give me any respect or any love or any attention that is what I really need.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a constant
battle. Universal.
It's a very universal thing. But you're right about the musical. It did very skillfully play that because they knew they were going for a Broadway run.
Mm-hmm. Almost dangerously so, really.
It was the first time that material had been on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
It had been off Broadway quite a bit, but never on Broadway and not in this blatant format. But they did things very carefully in the original production. George and Albin never kissed in the original production. They held hands at one point, but there was never any kissing, physical contact. The Cagels, which was the chorus line of showgirls, in quotes, there were 12 of them, 10 of them were men and 2 of them were women. And so the game was to guess, well, you can't tell which one is the women, can you?
Mm.
And so that was an attempt to sort of educate the audience. This newer version we're doing, there's no question these are guys, but these are guys in dresses painted up, because we're used to it now.
Yeah.
We're used to it with you know, the drag queen thing is not new.
Maybe you don't know the answer to this yet, but when you present sort of a much beloved work like La Cage, do you kind of battle expectations? Is there a higher bar that's set? Or is it kind of like playing a greatest hit where the audience is, you're pretty confident they'll immediately get into it because they know the source material?
It's a little bit of both, I think. But I'll reverse that. You have the advantage because they're familiar with it, so they come into it predisposed to like you.
Yeah.
Right? They come in wanting to have a really terrific experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't deliver on that experience,
that's when you hear about it. That's
when you hear about it. That's when you're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you do something no one's ever heard of and you don't do a very good job of it and you're playing to smaller houses, you know, you don't get the kickback that you will if you do something that's really beloved and it just doesn't meet people's expectations. That's very difficult.
Well, it's the 20th anniversary season.
Yes, we're just finishing it up.
Talk about the wide range of experiences that you've had this season. You've had the sophisticated comedy Regrets Only.
Yes, which was also about gay marriage, actually.
Yeah. It was actually kind of similar, except set in a kind of sophisticated...
Upper
New York City.
West Side New York.
Yeah.
New York
you've
milieu.
Had the Howard Crabtree's Whoop-Dee-Doo, and then you've had more serious works like... Alexa K. Campbell's The Price.
The Pride.
The Pride, excuse me.
Yeah, The Pride.
How does RTP choose the plays it wants to produce?
We have a terrific artistic director named John Knapp, who has guided all those choices for the last almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think virtually every season, perhaps except the very beginning couple. And he is very knowledgeable about theater and gay theater as a niche, LGBT-focused theater as a niche. So he's very aware of what is out there. And he always tries to give us a good balance, and particularly more so as we've grown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back when we were founded 20 years ago, it really was more about us telling our stories to our own, because nobody was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And providing a space where it was very safe for gay and lesbian folks to gather
Right.
And here's
they were already there.
Yeah, at Fieldon's. And they knew that space mm-hmm. was a safe place. It was theirs and a safe place to go. So it enabled us to gather as a community and hear our stories in a place where it was okay just to be us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't have to be out in the greater Richmond world and perhaps try to pretend to be something that we're not. Over this past 20 years, I think that's transformed quite a bit. I think our community has transformed. I'd like to think RTP's been a bit of a catalyst in that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So now when we are telling the stories, we are aware. In fact, we are hopeful that we have a much wider audience sitting out there. So we're not just telling our stories to ourselves. We're sort of relating why it's good to have diversity in your community.
Right.
Why it's terrific that we don't all look the same and act the same mm-hmm. and have the same beliefs.
Right.
That the conversation is what makes the community stronger and more important. So that's a bit, it's a different direction, if you will, that's evolved for us over 20 years. We're still always going to be focused on plays of relevance to that community and any messaging that has to do with, we just rewrote the mission and I'm probably gonna get it wrong, gender identity and sexual orientation. I think that's what we've talked about rather mm-hmm. than using the long list of alphabet, you know, letters.
Right.
That are now needed for our community because it's broadened so much. But I think that's important. I think it's an important shift for what we've done.
Talk a little bit. Let's go back a little bit to the early days. Mm-hmm. Have you been with the company since its early days?
I have been with the company. I've been associated with the company for almost 12 years now.
Okay.
So it's been a long time.
What was wrong with Fieldon's other than you couldn't climb those stairs?
Well, the stairs were an issue. The stage size was an issue. The
uh-huh.
stage was
yeah,
like
I
a postage that. Stamp,
yeah.
if you
mm-hmm.
remember. So and there was no backstage, there was no flies, there was no real
yeah,
lighting or sound.
Yeah, how did you get around that? Where would you do the changeovers?
The actors would literally climb stairs behind stage to go to the third floor attic to change their clothes, and then they had to run downstairs.
Oh, man.
There was a tiny little space behind the stage, but very often we had to break through that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we needed it for stage space. It was a bit of a nightmare. And I think, you know, we could have stayed there longer, except that the management of the club, you
mm-hmm.
know, we rented mm-hmm. space from Fieldon's, the club.
Mm-hmm.
The management of the club just wasn't in the position to keep the building up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's ignore the fact you walked into it and it was a little dank and extremely smoky, even though we weren't allowing smoking during the shows. I mean, it was just like
years of accumulated.
Yeah. It was a little dank. It was a little, you know, you didn't want to quite look down at your feet to, you know, look at the floor. We don't want to even discuss the state of the bathrooms. So it was beginning to sort of crumble around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that and our audiences, which were becoming broader,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and attracting a wider segment of the Richmond population. We're going, hey, kids, you know, we like what you do on stage, but this building, ugh.
Mm-hmm.
And people were starting to tell us, we just can't come anymore, either because of the stairs or they felt they were going to die in a fire or, you know, something.
Right.
So we knew that it was time to go.
Well, talk about the successful capital campaign to get you guys into a new home and talk a little bit about how you found the new home. It's a I think it was a former radiator shop.
It was a radiator repair shop. It was interesting. At our 15th anniversary, 5 years ago, we threw a big party. We threw a 15th anniversary party, and we did it at the Jefferson. And we'd never done anything like that before.
Mm-hmm.
And we drew a nice crowd. And what we did is we told the story. We said, you know, this is our dream. And at that point, we had already done some work dreaming ourselves, and we had gotten an architect friend to draw up, you know, some drawings.
So you made a production of the pitch.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And we did, and that was the show.
Uh-huh.
The show was the pitch to which, we, you know, you had come to paid money. You
yeah.
actually paid money to hear us pitch you an idea. And then we gave you a little show and some hors d'oeuvres and drinks and all that. But we you know, told the dream. And, of course, the dream was a $2.5 million building that we knew we would never get, nor did we really deserve,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But we knew it would just spark people's imagination.
Right.
So there
what
was
if?
A, what if? So there was a real estate entrepreneur who was there named Rob Moss, who had been a patron of ours, and he said, you know, and this is, remember, this is before the real estate market crashed, And he said, I've been looking to buy some property in Scott's Addition. Would you be interested? And there is one that I think would make a great theater. Mm-hmm. And I would buy it, and then you would simply pay the mortgage and fees, just as if you owned it. But I'll, you know, it'll be on my my dime that I'll do that for you. We went, great. That sounds like a terrific idea. And since we had done all that pre-planning, we knew what we needed. We knew what kind of stage space we needed and blah, blah, blah. And Mike Gooding, who was then the managing director, who'd been the volunteer managing director since the founding of the company, he was able to go with Rob and walk in and goes, yeah, this is great. Mm-hmm. This will work. This will work beautifully. So once we had the space secure, then we launched the capital campaign. Now, of course, just as we launched it, the whole economy went into the dumper.
Right.
So we had to reconfigure what we did, but we worked with a wonderful construction company, Daniel and Company, and they worked very closely with us to sort of vet every single thing that was in that construction plan from the architects. And we worked with the architects, which was Evolve Architecture, and with Daniel, and just sort of combed through it and said, okay, can we cut that? Can we not do this? Mm-hmm. Can we do this a slightly cheaper way and still get the same effect that we're all looking for? And they did wonderful things. I mean, we got all the wall coverings in that space were donated, all the non-theatrical lights were donated, all the floor coverings were donated. We brought the chairs with us from Field Inns. We had to get them cleaned, but we brought all that over and all the lighting and sound stuff, so we were good to go.
And I heard that you also had some help, some outside help from some VCU students, too.
Oh, yeah, and the Richmond Men's Chorus. People came in to paint and took care of the building, and we had a marvelous amount of support from the community. Anyone who could lend a hand sort of came to our aid and did it, which was great.
Well, I assume that you take audience surveys to find out who your audience is. Talk about how the new space has kind of helped the theater gain a new audience. I heard that you actually have more heterosexual patrons for some shows than gay patrons.
We do. We do. I was at a Sunday matinee recently. And I looked at the audience walking in. And, you know, you do your best audience research just by standing. Mm-hmm. And looking at your customers. And, you know, just as they all walked in and I looked at the stage manager, I said, I thought we were doing a gay theater here. Where are the gay people? You know? But that's great.
Absolutely.
That's great because it means we're telling our message to the people we want to get to. Mm-hmm. It means they're responding. It means they like what we're doing. So we're thrilled. We did a survey before we left Field Inns, and about 30% of our audience self-identified as straight. Mm-hmm. And I bet you our numbers have exactly flipped. I will bet you now that our probably 60 to 70% of our audience.
Now knowing that, does that then affect what you decide to put on? Knowing that you don't have to just fulfill maybe a niche, that you can broaden the scope a little bit.
Sure, I think it opens us up to more things. We've started an initiative where we want to produce plays that were written by gay and lesbian authors, but perhaps don't have a lot of material in the plays themselves. So part of when we participated in the Tennessee Williams
Festival. Right, you've done Tennessee
Williams,
yeah.
Right. There's not much in most of his work that's a you know.
So it's not overtly. Yeah.
So, but he's a very important author. We're looking at a play. Well, in fact.
Did Suddenly Last Summer, right?
We did Suddenly Last Summer. Mm-hmm. We're going to open the season next year. I can't announce the rest of it, but Henley has already announced their season, and we're a part of that.
Oh, come on.
No, I can't do it. We're going to announce it Sunday, May 19th, though. but the first show will be in The Importance of Being Earnest, which we're going to co-produce with Henley Street and with Richmond Shakespeare in our space. Now, of course, Oscar Wilde, who wrote Importance of Being Earnest, was probably the gayest human being of the entire 19th century.
Sure.
And very open about it. In fact, was jailed and died in jail because of it. But the play is simply one of the greatest classic comedies ever written. Mm-hmm. So there you are.
Right.
So that it does open that up a little bit for us.
Give me a little background on the organization itself. It's a 501c3
nonprofit,
and you have
theater.
A board of directors.
We do.
How often do they meet with? Do you meet with them? What's the protocol for the Triangle Players?
Well, we have a board that takes its role very seriously. Mm-hmm. We have been, in fact, very actively trying to build the board. There's a growth cycle with every kind of nonprofit, and particularly with an arts organization, mm-hmm. where you start And the board and all your volunteers are the people who need to basically fill staff positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be involved with us because we need a sound, we need a stage manager, and we need someone to do the costumes and the lights. And that's how people get involved. As you grow, then you start looking at, gee, we want to sort of maybe up the ante of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps we need to engage professionals. Now, one of the things we did very early on, from our first season on, we always paid actors, just like everybody else in town.
Mm-hmm.
We had some more issues earlier on with actors because there were some folks concerned that if they performed with us, perhaps they would be identified as being gay.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, if you had difficulty in finding actors.
In the early days. Now, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. We use the same pool of talent that most other theaters in town have. We've used, we've had actors on equity contracts at times. We've pulled in a couple actors from New York, actually, for a show we did last year, because we needed to audition in New York. But largely, it's been all local talent.
Well, now, you know why I'm asking this. How well do you get along with your board of directors? Do we have to worry about you, Phil?
No, I hope not. I hope
not. Looks like you're doing a good job, but that may be firing action.
I don't think so. I think it's about open, honest communication.
Mm.
And if there is that, if that exists in an organization and everyone is looking at the exact same goals,
mm-hmm.
everyone's on the same page, I think you minimize those problems. You always run the risk, as you bring new people onto the board, that they might have different views, different visions. But, you know, that's your job as an organization, to vet those folks.
Yeah.
You hire...
To get the right people in there in the first place.
You bring people on a board... You should pay the same attention to that you do as if you're hiring somebody for a job, because you actually are hiring somebody for a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a job for which they don't get paid. In fact, they usually are expected to give you money.
Yeah.
But it still is a job. And if they're not on the team, if you will, then you're going to have trouble. By the same token, if you hire in somebody as an artist or a manager, and we've seen this as well, you know, who doesn't click with the community or mm-hmm. isn't telling the stories that they want to be told or whatever, you can run into that problem as well.
Right.
Benny Ambush, who was the last managing director at Theater Virginia. I mean, one of the most talented artists I have ever encountered. And he's, you know, they hired the man who should have been running the eventual theater downtown
mm-hmm.
10 years later, but there was no way he should have been stuck in the position he was in.
Yeah.
At that theater at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course he failed.
Yeah.
Of course he failed dramatically, you know. And the issues we've had here in the local Virginia theater community recently have been tragic, I think. And I think that is simply because everything was done so badly.
Mm-hmm.
So badly.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen...
You're, of course, referring to the Firehouse Theater.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't like to see... As I told you earlier... You know, officially, Richmond Triangle Players is Switzerland.
Yeah.
We welcome any artist in town who wants to perform with us. Mm-hmm. No one is excluded. That mm-hmm. is everyone from the previous artistic management of Firehouse to folks who are performing there now. Artists are artists. They, you know, everyone has their own opinions about things, where they want to go. We embrace everybody.
Right.
You know, my whole idea is I don't discriminate against anybody.
Well, you're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking with Philip Crosby, the managing director of the Richmond Triangle Players. The theater company will conclude its 20th anniversary season with La Cage aux Folles, which opens tonight and plays through June 29th. Is that right?
Plays through June 15th.
June 15th, excuse
yep.
me. For more information on the theater company, one of Richmond's best and most active, you can go to rtriangle.com. Thanks for coming, Philip.
Actually, it's rtriangle.org.
Ah, much better.
I don't want them to be confused.
No, we want to send them to the right
place. We want to send them to the right place. Hey. Thank you for having me. This is a delight. I can't believe we're done.
I know. It went fast, didn't it?
It really... Well, you get me talking. Time flies.
We'll keep breaking those legs.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And that's Open Source RVA for May 17th, 2013. Thanks for joining us. I'm Chris Dovey. My co-hosts are Don Harrison and Scott Bass. The RPM News team is Brittany Tracy and Cameron Vigliano. Our producers are Jay Westerman and the ever-fabulous Gabby Scardust. Our board op is the lovely and enigmatic Mannion. Or perhaps one even more enigmatic than she. Have you seen Mike McKenzie in the forthcoming Richmond Triangle Players production of Smokey and the Bandit 2, the musical? Here's what the critics are saying. A flawed masterpiece, Culpepper curried crumpet. Dreck of the most divine, I cried more. I'm still crying, the Oxford Times. Enjoyed Open Source this week? Crying for more? Try the podcast of this and past great episodes of Open Source, available at rvaopensource.com. Feel free to click that little yellow donate button. Making all this news ain't easy. And please like us on Facebook or toss us a news tip on Twitter. We'll be back next week with Smokey and the Bandit, Part 3.